empathy and instinct. So it was easy for me to understand what it was like for people who had no power, no control over their lives. One of our former staff people, Pat Hoppins, said last week in one of these forums, she went to Mendota as a minister's wife. When she first got there, one of the farmer mothers came to her to ask her if she could continue this Spanish class that her predecessor had been teaching once a week. And Pat said, no, I can't do that. I don't know a word of Spanish. I could not possibly do that. I would make a mess of it. So they came back, and finally she agreed to do it. And she did it for a while, and then she realized, this is not my job. The school system should be doing this. So she went to the superintendent of schools and asked him, you know, can you send a teacher for these people? 30 men and women every week after work showed up for this class. And the principal and the superintendent said, no, we can't do that. We can't spend money and resources that way. No one will come. I said, what do you mean no one will come? They already are coming. He wouldn't budge. He didn't budge an inch. And so she got a real lesson in the power structure of the community that she was in.
Let's move on to the boycott.
Oh, okay. How much? Yeah. What are we doing on time?
Because we're...
Throw in questions if you have them.
But I'd like to get, let's go through a little bit more of this okay. Because I'd like to get to the point, on the workers, I think there's an important discussion later on about what the workers' interests were versus what, and your role and the church's role in that as well, right? So that's why
yeah.
I raised it now, because there's a point at which it's not so clear what's in the best interest of the workers necessarily. So so do just quickly kind of the boycott and what the importance of the church was, which was tremendous. I mean, in the boycott which led to the contracts in the grape fields in 1970 was started by Jim Drake, but was expanded by Chavez in 69.
I'll tell the story.
When Mexico, but I'm going to tell part of the story too. But just to set the background for what the church's role was that you had farm workers who were sent out with, many of them had never been outside California, some of them didn't speak English, had very little education. They were sent with essentially no money, like $100, and buttons to sell, and the names of a few friendly people in major cities across the country, Chicago, New York, Washington, Toronto,
Philadelphia, Boston,
and lived on and told to stop the sale of grapes in those cities. And the rather remarkable thing is that they succeeded. And the church as well as labor organizations were sort of the two key pillars of support when these kids, and they were pretty much kids, landed in these cities. You know, they usually went to stay with someone either from the church or from the UAW or another major labor organization. And they then had to sort of build an infrastructure in that city of people to, you know, get people to stop buying grapes. And the pitch was, you know, here, I'm a farm worker, I'm 1,500 miles from home, I've given up everything, I'm living on $5 a week in room and board, which is what everybody who works for the UFW made, and, you know, and all I'm asking you to do is not to buy grapes. For those who are familiar with what the Immokalee workers are doing in Florida, there's some parallels right now to what they're doing. But you and the migrant ministry and the churches in general later on played a major role in the boycott in terms of support and mobilizing public opinion.
True.
You agreed with me on something.
By the way, most of them had never been out of a warm climate.
Right.
And they were going to places like Cleveland and Pittsburgh and Chicago and New York and Boston and all these cold, wintry, English-speaking places. And I used to say, like, how could anybody with any kind of a heart say no to these folks? They tell their story of what it's like to be a grape worker, and then they tell their story of the strike, and they tell how they came to be in Chicago, and like who could say no? I'm gonna keep eating grapes. I love grapes. I mean, you know,
Richard Nixon
did it. John Ronald Reagan did it. But But, I mean, they couldn't do that. And so, but what happened to people was they stopped eating grapes. And then once the boycotter got a little more settled in his place, there would be picket lines on Saturdays. And then people would come and they were really leafleting. They weren't picket lines. They were leafleting people and then talking to them about the grapes.
And asking, they would target like one particular store and ask people not to shop at that store until they stopped carrying grapes from California.
It started as just boycott grapes, but then eventually it shifted to major chain stores. Don't buy at this store until this store takes the grapes off the shelves.
And ultimately it was the pressure from those major chains that forced the growers in California to sign contracts.
But do you know what happened in the churches? First of all, I mean, we were like a visible sign of the church's involvement. We had all this history and propaganda to dispense or to send to people if they had questions. But what would happen, say, in Chicago is, you know, Olga Salmon just got involved. She leafleted. And then she went to the boycott meetings. And then she went inside the store to pray around the grape counter. And then she would put grapes in the bottom of her shopping cart and fill it with other groceries and then leave it at the check counter saying, "Oh, I forgot my wallet." I mean, this is a really, really nice church lady. then they would go in the store until they were arrested. And so little step by step by step, people got just so involved in the movement, and it became the second life for them, and a beautiful opportunity to do something that they always wanted to do, always believed in. I used to say people love Caesar God because he's a great speaker, but because his words match his deeds, but secondly because he's reaching for the best inside of each one of us. And when we do our best, we feel good about ourselves, and we love him because of it. And but then Olga is an active member of the United Church of Christ, so she goes to her synod and demands that they pass resolutions boycott grape. And then she goes to the National Synod and demands that the National Synod, and that happened with ministers and lay people all over the country. They first make contact with these farm workers who came to their city, and then they get so committed to the cause that they know that their church should do the right thing. And they're gonna fight and fight and fight until the church does the right thing. Now, while the church is in the process of trying to make up its mind about doing the right thing, they will send us letters or have our phone calls saying, "What does the migrant ministry say about this?" Like we're an objective church source, right, for information. But it's kind of like it's true. They viewed us as that way. We tried to say always, we always tried always to be honest in what we put out. We didn't always say everything. But we tried to be honest about the material we put out. And so this church, while they're struggling with this issue, would ask for us for information or ask me to come and talk to them or in some way. So the migrant ministry was kind of like a backup for these local church folks who had gotten so involved in the boycott. So we were important in the success of the boycott, but the farm workers coming across the country was key. They were the key to the boycott, without a doubt. Matt.
We had, my mom counted up that by the time I was 18, 21 different houses, including about six in Delano. And my dad would like, when he started the New York boycott in 68 or whatever, came out, found a place in Jersey City. It was the cheapest place he could find. They had no doors on it. And we were coming, from nice, sunny California, pretty rural, pretty laid back, coming thrust right into the Jersey City central school system. There was no place to play. There was a park, but it was covered in broken glass. And every night we'd be woken to the sounds of people running down the street, breaking the car mirrors and windows on the street. So you can't like underestimate the sacrifice that people made. Mm-hmm. And I think that part of why other people were so willing to jump in and give $20 or $100 because it was just, it was palpable. You could see the sacrifice, not just in the farmers, but in everybody else that went for $5 a month or the ministers who paid slightly more. Everybody was sacrificing so much that it was easy for other people to want to get involved. Kind of like, you know, like the Obama movement really caught fire here, and it was really exciting for a little while because everybody could feel part of something. And that's a really hard feeling to keep fired up, keep momentum going. You know? It was cool for a while.
Well, that great boycott became so strong that the growers couldn't actually sell their grapes at a profit.
Not, you know, they really could. It was that the retailers did not want to put up with all of the hassles of having to deal with the picketers and everything. It was more that, and the growers will say that too.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. And
but it was like the nuisances. It was the supermarkets. It was the people would fill the shopping carts. This is my favorite. They would put all the frozen stuff on the bottom of the shopping cart and then fill it up with all the other stuff. And they go to the checkout and then say, "Do you sell grapes here?" And when they said yes, they would just walk away and leave the cart. And they were all.
But there was a whole generation that didn't eat grapes that knew about this. Epistemology meant morality.
How many in this room knew of the Great Boycott? Pardon?
They weren't even born. Come on.
Say that for us.
I learned about it later.
I was born in 1980, so I learned about it.
Well, you know, there's a whole generation coming up who doesn't know who Cesar Chavez is.
Right.
Yeah. My dad stole a box of grapes a farmer gave him a box of grapes when we were living in La Paz, and he brought in this crate of grapes. And, like, we were like, oh my God, what's that dude at a house? We were like 8, 9 years old. My dad said, no, how come they're okay? You know, you can eat these. No way.
Yeah, in 1969, Caesar went out this was like a year after his first fast, and he was weak and his back was bad, but he went out on this tour around the country to every boycott city. It ended up being a 3-month tour, and he had his favorite joke, which John just, he would, every night he would warm up the audience with this joke about a woman who took her daughter shopping with her. And as they were passing the grape counter, the little girl would tug on her skirt and say, "Mommy, Mommy, when are you going to be able to eat those boycotts?" And everybody just cracked up. But Caesar was in such pain on such some nights, and one night he was in such pain that he left out a key sentence in the joke, and no one laughed. And he came down, he said, "Chris, why didn't anyone laugh? What's wrong with these people? Everybody laughs at that joke." I said, "Well, Caesar, you kind of left out an important, you left out an important phrase." But that's how, well, it was, the Harris did a poll, a national poll.
In 1975.
In 1970-something, five. It showed that 17 million Americans were boycotting grapes.
Or lettuce or gallo.
Yeah. So it was it was like the whole thing was a miracle. I mean, but it was a miracle led by a guy who knew what he was doing and could lead us in the direction of winning this fight. So in 1970, all the grape growers, Coachella, Bakersfield, Arvin, Delano, all of them came together and signed contracts with the United Farm Workers. And that's where the box with union labels came from.
So let's skip over 70 to 73 and go to the law, okay? Since you mentioned 75. Because
okay.
I can summarize very, there are contracts in 1970, there are a lot of issues involving the management of those contracts, which are a whole separate story. The Teamsters come, they steal the contracts away, they sign sweetheart deals. By 1973, the union has almost no contracts left, is all but written off in some circles, right? There's a cover story in the New York Times Magazine that essentially says, it's all over, it was great while it lasted, but they're dead. And instead, the union survives because of this movement sensibility and because of all the people who have been drawn into the fight, right? And there are a series of strikes in 1973, and as a price for support, a strike fund from the AFL-CIO in 1973 of $1.7 million, then a lot more money, Chavez agrees to support legislation that would regulate elections in the fields in California. We should say, in case for people who may not know this, that farm workers and domestic workers are the two groups of workers who are not covered by the National Labor Relations Act, so they had no rights, they had no right to organize. The labor movement was sort of wanted an end to this, could see this was gonna go on forever, it was costly, it was draining resources and energy. And so Chavez, who described himself as his favorite role was to be the nonviolent Viet Cong and really liked operating in a world where there weren't a lot of rules and he could do whatever he wanted, was not all that thrilled with this idea, but it was the price for getting the strike fund, so he agreed to support legislation, not really probably thinking that he would ever get quite the law that he got, but a very young Jerry Brown, who is now potentially going to be once again the oldest governor of California, was elected in 1974, came in very committed to doing something for farm workers through a whole combination of negotiations and pressure from the boycott, from the supermarkets who were tired of this, from the growers who were tired of this, from the Teamsters. The growers were tired of dealing with the Teamsters by then as well. And the civil disobedience, there were 3,500 people arrested in the summer of 1973 who went to jail, which is a whole other interesting story. But all of these forces kind of come together in 1975, and the state passes the California Agricultural Labor Relations Act, still the only law on the books in the United States that gives farm workers the right to organize. And it is probably one of, if not the most pro-labor laws in the country. It establishes a board that regulates the elections. It sets up a seven. It has, actually, the people who are trying to rewrite the NLRA at this point with the Employee Free Choice Act, if you guys are following that at all, a lot of the things that are trying to be written into that are modeled on the ALRA, because it had the presumption of elections first and challenges after, and all sorts of other things that really were helpful, much more helpful than the NLRA. So everything suddenly changes, right? All of a sudden, boycotts off. It's all about going out and winning elections. And how does that change your role, the role of the ministry, then by now the National Farm Worker Ministry?
Well. It's a classic. It was a classic good cop, bad cop legislative victory, and it's true. Caesar probably didn't think they would win the law that they won, because the UFW took this hard pro-labor position on collective bargaining, and the governor took like a softer position. So then we all attacked the governor. And in the meantime, Jerry Cohen, the general counsel of the UFW, is negotiating with the governor, and the growers are involved, and the supermarkets are involved, and everybody's involved, and out of all that came this law that we now have, and has actually been improved since 1975. And it is, without a doubt, the best collective bargaining law
in the country.
And if it could be a model for a new National Labor Relations Act, it would be a vast improvement, because, well, you remember better than I do, once a petition for an election is filed,
7 days.
The election has to happen in 7 days. So you don't have this long period that employers use to crush the union majority at a whatever. And then there's sanctions for growers who bargain in bad faith. They have to make whole their workers if they have delayed negotiations in a contract. And there's all kinds of wonderful, wonderful benefits to this law. But Caesar was kind of like a reluctant dragon.
So what becomes the role? You had mixed feelings about it at the time, about your own.
No, I mean, I was all in favor of the law.
Right, no, but you were sort of, you lost enthusiasm, you were concerned about what your